at four council members, so I'm calling it a quorum, so we can go ahead and start our Columbia City Council pre-council for November 4th, 2024. Our main discussion is the transit study discussion, so I'm assuming that I'm kicking this to you, Shane.
Yeah. Sean Strait with Olson Associates is here tonight to talk about the transit study. While I'm sure Sean will touch on this in his presentation, I just wanted to quickly highlight the extensive engagement that went into the study. The Public Transit Advisory Commission developed the study scope and served as the steering committee for the study. Olson held three public open house meetings and conducted an onboard rider survey. In addition, they met individually with council members and county commission members. They also met with several city leaders, MoDOT, and the University of Missouri. Staff worked hard on the front end to make sure boards and commissions, such as the Energy and Environment Commission, Human Rights Commission, and Disabilities Commission, were aware of the project and encouraged to participate. In addition, PTAC held an event during Earth Day where they gathered additional feedback for Olson. The project was also prominently displayed on the city's Be Heard page throughout the study. With that, I'll turn it over to Sean.
Thank you, Shane. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council, for having me here today. And thank you for, the last time I met with each of you about a year ago in the part of the stakeholder interview process that we had at the beginning of the project. We appreciate your help at that point, giving us direction for the project, guidance, ideas, et cetera. So tonight, happy to bring a draft report of the results of our study. Take questions and comments. Based on that, have some discussion, some of the draft recommendations that we have in here, and happy to answer any questions. So I'll go through sort of walking through the draft plan document, sort of in slide form here, and then kind of open it up to some discussions and Q&A as we go along as well. Feel free to stop me along the way as well if you think of something or see something that you'd like to discuss as I'm going through it. Happy to stop as needed. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started here. I'm Sean Strait. I'm with Olson. I've been the project manager for this project, based out of our Kansas City office, and lead a lot of our transit work, particularly Missouri, Kansas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and really have enjoyed working on this project for the city of Columbia. So getting into kind of the purpose of the plan, kind of a multi-purpose process here. Our current services meeting local and regional needs as they're operating now. And then what is the community's vision for transit? So we're looking at the near term, but also longer term. We want to know kind of where we want to go long term, what we want transit to be in Columbia over the long term as well. So this involves reviewing shifting needs, evaluating some new markets potentially in the city and in the region, conducting a lot of community engagement. Shane talked about that a little bit at the outset. And we'll touch on that a little bit later as well. And then ultimately ending up with an actionable plan that addresses staffing needs, system integration, and steps for implementation as we get to some of the recommendations later here. One thing I will point out kind of at the outset here is that I kind of show this flyer here. So this was when last August, due to staffing challenges, service had to be reduced in order to ensure the schedules could be operated reliably. So as part of our study, we're really focusing on how to improve from the baseline service that existed prior to this. We're not so much focused on how to get back to this service level that existed prior to August of last year, because frankly, you don't need to hire a consultant to tell you that you want to get staff back up to that level of service. We're kind of focused on that as a baseline, and how do we move forward from that, both in the near term and long term. So a bit of a clarification at the outset. If you have looked at the draft report, we refer to this as the baseline service. And so baseline meaning the service that existed prior to those reductions in August of last year, because that's really the service that you want to be operating now as soon as you get staffed up to be able to do that. A few words about the plan process. So this is essentially how the report is organized in these five sections here. So we have the market analysis, so that's a review of demographic transportation data, planning background, peer agency review. And then secondly, we have the operations analysis, so that's taking a deep dive of the existing system as it operates now. And then number three, the goal setting and strategy. So this is really the visioning aspect of the plan. So what are the priorities of the community? What do we want transit to be? And then service recommendations. So based on all of this pre-work, what are we actually recommending in the short term and the long term? And then implementation, some guidance as to how do we go about implementing some of these recommendations. So that's essentially how the process is structured and how the report is structured as well. So the market analysis. So this is the first part of the plan. And the first part of that is planning background. So that's diving into past transit plans. There was the most recent kind of system-wide transit plan was 2016-2017. So learning from some of those past processes, campus transit plan dating back a little bit further, but also the city's comprehensive plan. So making sure we're tying transportation to land use policy, which is really important. Regional transportation plan, CATSO, and the long-range transportation plan, transportation improvement program, essentially learning from recent and past planning documents as it brings us to this time. And then a market analysis of the population and employment profile of the county. So city and county obviously continue to grow. Employment patterns were reviewed as part of the process as well, understanding where those exist in the community. And really seeing the continued growth of the community, but really the transit system hasn't been able to keep up with that growth. So the transit system in terms of annual operating hours has not really increased that much over this time that the city and the county have both been growing. And so how do we adjust that transit system? How do we grow that transit system to meet the increasing transportation needs of the community?
Can I see your quick?
Yeah.
Stanley, are you okay if people have questions?
Yes.
Okay, councilors. Can I ask you a quick question then on that? When you were looking at the market analysis and the employment, you show that University of Missouri has, you know, like 8,700 of it. This might not be something that you got into, but when you showed that later on, you showed the comparables of other college towns.
Yeah.
Do they have numbers on the percentage of employees of those industries or of like the colleges that ride transit so that we would have like a goal of what percentage we might be able to attract to ride transit if we did a partnership?
There's ridership numbers and then I can get enrollment and employment numbers and make calculations off of that. There's not really direct data on the number of students or staff that are riding necessarily.
Okay.
But I could make a comparison of, right, we have the ridership numbers, we have the enrollment numbers. I don't think we directly say that in the plan. I think we do have percentages of enrollment as a percentage of city population
as a way of
identifying the peer cities that we looked at.
Right.
But that's a calculation that's fairly easily to do that will sort of answer that question.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Nick, did you have a question?
It's okay. You sort of spoke to it
with
yours.
Okay. Thank you.
And so then the next aspect of this is transit propensity. So this is essentially evaluating the factors that are indicative of transit demand or need. And so this is a function of household income, households living in poverty or near poverty levels. It's a function of car ownership. Households that don't own any cars or may only own one car. Those are really two of the biggest drivers of transit need and propensity, but also senior population, disabled population, are also important components of that as well. And so we essentially look at each of these factors. We get a sense of what the total numbers are. We get a sense of where those populations exist throughout the community. Overlay that with the existing system to give us a sense of where some of those gaps are. It's kind of as we drive into the operations analysis and leading into the recommendations. So getting a sense of where that need exists in the community. And geographically, most of these areas of high propensity are being served now with existing services. The primary issue, and we'll get into this quite a bit more later, being the amount of service in terms of how often the buses run, the hours that they run. Geographically, many of the populations are served as system service levels don't really allow people to ride that might want to be able to ride.
It didn't look like anything stood out as being unusual. Like in comparison, there are no data points that like, oh, you're really unique in this one.
I mean, so when we get into the peer analysis, a few things jump out a little more there. I'd say each of these are comparisons. We're comparing the city to the county, to the state, to the country.
Right.
So less of a senior population, that's a function of having a major university. So that's why when we get into the peer analysis, you'll see, a lot of other cities are in a similar situation. So that's probably one that stands out in terms of comparing it to, like, state and national levels, for example. A lot of these numbers are, disabled population gets a little bit of that data as well in terms of, as a proportion of the community, not quite as many senior populations as compared to the community as a whole. Some of these other numbers are pretty similar to like state and national averages in terms of zero-car households, poverty status, for example. Poverty status, the city jumps out a little bit higher in terms of regionally and statewide and nationally as well. Wouldn't say it's necessarily a huge difference, but a bit of a notable difference there. And just in terms of the number of households, the 26,000 population, it's a fairly high number. There's a lot of people that if they're not currently transit users, they could benefit from transit services from the standpoint of cost and transportation cost. So a few items to note specifically there.
All right, we've got four council members, so I'm calling it a quorum, so we can go ahead and start our Columbia City Council pre-council for November 4th, 2024. Our main discussion is the transit study discussion, so I'm assuming that I'm kicking this to you, Shane.
Yeah. Sean Strait with Olson Associates is here tonight to talk about the transit study. While I'm sure Sean will touch on this in his presentation, I just wanted to quickly highlight the extensive engagement that went into the study. The Public Transit Advisory Commission developed the study scope and served as the steering committee for the study. Olson held three public open house meetings and conducted an onboard rider survey. In addition, they met individually with council members and county commission members. They also met with several city leaders, MoDOT, and the University of Missouri. Staff worked hard on the front end to make sure boards and commissions, such as the Energy and Environment Commission, Human Rights Commission, and Disabilities Commission, were aware of the project and encouraged to participate. In addition, PTAC held an event during Earth Day where they gathered additional feedback for Olson. The project was also prominently displayed on the city's Be Heard page throughout the study. With that, I'll turn it over to Sean.
Thank you, Shane. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council, for having me here today. And thank you for, the last time I met with each of you about a year ago in the part of the stakeholder review process that we had at the beginning of the project. We appreciate your help at that point, giving us direction for the project, guidance, ideas, et cetera. So tonight, happy to bring a draft report of the results of our study, take questions and comments based on that, have some discussion, some of the draft recommendations that we have in here, and happy to answer any questions. So I'll go through sort of walking through the draft plan document sort of in slide form here, and then kind of open it up to some discussions and Q&A as we go along as well. Feel free to stop me along the way as well if you think of something or see something that you'd like to discuss as I'm going through it. Happy to stop as needed. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started here. I'm Sean Strait. I'm with Olson. I've been the project manager for this project based out of our Kansas City office and lead a lot of our transit work, particularly Missouri, Kansas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and really have enjoyed working on this project for the city of Columbia. So getting into kind of the purpose of the plan, kind of a multi-purpose process here. Our current services meeting local and regional needs as they're operating now. And then what is the community's vision for transit? So we're looking at the near term, but also longer term. We want to know kind of where we want to go long term, what we want transit to be in Columbia over the long term as well. So this involves reviewing shifting needs, evaluating some new markets potentially in the city and in the region, conducting a lot of community engagement. Shane talked about that a little bit at the outset, and we'll touch on that a little bit later as well. And then ultimately ending up with an actionable plan that addresses staffing needs, system integration, and steps for implementation as we get to some of the recommendations later here. One thing I will point out kind of at the outset here is that it kind of showed this flyer here. So this was when last August, due to staffing challenges, service had to be reduced in order to ensure the schedules could be operated reliably. So as part of our study, we're really focusing on how to improve from the baseline service that existed prior to this. We're not so much focused on how to get back to this service level that existed prior to August of last year. Because frankly, you don't need to hire a consultant to tell you that you want to get staff back up to that level of service. We're kind of focused on that as a baseline, and how do we move forward from that, both in the near term and long term. So a bit of a clarification at the outset. If you have looked at the draft report, we refer to this as the baseline service. And so baseline meaning the service that existed prior to those reductions in August of last year, because that's really the service that you want to be operating now as soon as you get staffed up to be able to do that. So a few words about the plan process. So this is essentially how the report is organized in these five sections here. So we have the market analysis. So that's a review of demographic, transportation data, planning background, peer agency review. And secondly, we have the operations analysis. So that's taking a deep dive of the existing system as it operates now. And then number three, the goal setting and strategy. So this is really the visioning aspect of the plan. So what are the priorities of the community? What do we want transit to be? And then service recommendations. So based on all of this pre-work, what are we actually recommending in the short term and the long term? And then implementation, some guidance as to how do we go about implementing some of these recommendations. So that's essentially how the process is structured and how the report is structured as well. So the market analysis. So this is the first part of the plan. And the first part of that is planning background. So that's diving into past transit plans. There was the most recent kind of system-wide transit plan was 2016-2017. So learning from some of those past processes, campus transit plan dating back a little bit further, but also the city's comprehensive plan, so making sure we're tying transportation to land use policy, which is really important. Regional transportation plan, CATSO, and the long-range transportation plan, transportation improvement program, essentially learning from recent and past planning documents as it brings us to this time. And then a market analysis of the population and employment profile of the county. City and county obviously continue to grow. Employment patterns were reviewed as part of the process as well, understanding where those exist in the community. And really seeing the continued growth of the community, but really the transit system hasn't been able to keep up with that growth. So the transit system in terms of annual operating hours has not really increased that much over this time that the city and the county have both been growing. And so how do we adjust that transit system? How do we grow that transit system to meet the increasing transportation needs of the community?
Can I ask you a quick, yeah. Stanley, are you okay if people have questions?
Yes. Or,
mm-hmm. Okay, councilors. Can I ask you a quick question then on that? When you were looking at the market analysis and the employment, you show that University of Missouri has, you know, like 8,700 of it. This might not be something that you got into, but when you showed that later on, you showed the comparables of other college towns.
Yeah.
Do they have numbers on the percentage of employees of those industries or of like the colleges that ride transit so that we would have like a goal of what percentage we might be able to attract to ride transit if we did a partnership?
There's ridership numbers, and then I can get enrollment and employment numbers and make calculations off of that. There's not really direct data on the number of students or staff that are riding necessarily, but I could make a comparison of riding. We have the ridership numbers, we have the enrollment numbers. I don't think we directly say that in the plan. I think we do have percentages of enrollment as a percentage of city population as a way of identifying the peer cities that we looked at,
right?
But that's a calculation that's fairly easily to do that will sort of answer that question.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Nick, did you have a question?
It's okay, you sort of spoke to it
okay.
with yours.
Okay, sorry. Thank you.
And so then the next aspect of this is transit propensity. So this is essentially evaluating the factors that are indicative of transit demand or need. And so this is a function of household income. Households living in poverty or near poverty levels. It's a function of car ownership. Households that don't own any cars or may only own one car. Those are really two of the biggest drivers of transit need and propensity, but also senior population, disabled population are also important components of that as well. And so we essentially look at each of these factors. We get a sense of what the total numbers are. We get a sense of where those populations exist throughout the community. Overlay that with the existing system to give us a sense of where some of those gaps are. It's kind of as we drive into the operations analysis and leading into the recommendations. So getting a sense of where that need exists in the community. And geographically, most of these areas of high propensity are being served now with existing services. The primary issue, and we'll get into this quite a bit more later, being the amount of service in terms of how often the buses run, the hours that they run. Geographically, many of the populations are served as service levels don't really allow people to ride that might want to be able to ride.
It didn't look like anything stood out as being unusual, like in comparison, like there were no data points that went, oh, you're really unique in this one.
I mean, so when we get into the peer analysis, a few things jump out a little more there. I'd say not. I mean, really, each of these are comparisons where we're comparing the city to the county, to the state, to the country.
Right.
So, obviously, less of a senior population. That's a function of having a major university in the community. So that's why when we get into the peer analysis, you'll see, a lot of other cities are in a similar situation. So that's probably one that stands out in terms of comparing it to like state and national levels, for example. A lot of these numbers are, disabled population. It's a little bit of that data as well in terms of, as a proportion of the community, not quite as many senior populations as compared to the community as a whole. Some of these other numbers are pretty similar to like state and national averages in terms of zero-car households. Poverty status, for example. Poverty status, the city jumps out a little bit higher in terms of regionally and statewide and nationally as well. Wouldn't say it's necessarily a huge difference, but a bit of a notable difference there. And just in terms of the number of households, the 26,000 population, that's a fairly high number. That's a lot of people that if they're not currently transit users, they could benefit from transit services from the standpoint of cost. A few items to note specifically there. So the peer agency review. So this is the part where we ended up looking at 9 other cities that have similarities to Columbia in terms of similar population size, similar mix of transit services, and having a major university. Now, some of these are larger, some of these are smaller, but getting a sense of some other places and what they look like in terms of amount of transit service, ridership, and other data. And so really the key point here, and you'll see Columbia is kind of the darker blue bar on these graphs here. The top graph here is unlinked passenger trips, that's ridership. So you'll see that Columbia is, compared to its peers, on the lower end of total ridership compared to these peers. And that's because there's less overall service. That's the second graph here. Vehicle revenue hours is essentially a measure of the amount of transit service that's operating in the city. Now, what's really interesting is, so even though lower in terms of overall ridership because of the lower amounts of service, when you take the ridership per hour of service, so it's a standard industry metric of efficiency and effectiveness of the service, ridership per hour, Columbia actually fares quite well compared to a lot of the peers. And so that's really showing that the service that runs now is efficient and actually attracts quite a few riders. It's just we don't quite have enough of that service, and really showing probably some unmet demand here, just based on the numbers that we're seeing that actually in the upper half of peers there. So I thought that was definitely notable and kind of drove some of our thinking and our process about there would probably be quite a bit of unmet need in terms of if we can get the service levels up, we would probably see a pretty large uptick in ridership as well as some of these other places have.
Nick has a question. Oh, yeah. You got it. Never mind.
You got it. Thanks.
Just keep thinking them and the answers will come to you.
All sorts of kind of details here that, for example, we see Champaign-Urbana, Illinois kind of jumping off the graph here. They get a lot of state money. And that's, so you'll see some changes here with, that's the one that kind of stands out the most that just, kind of happened to know about. The state of Illinois funds transit per capita at a much greater level than Missouri and really most of the surrounding states as well. So, a lot of that comes down to funding, and in that case particular, state funding is a
I'm just going to call that out because you underlined that.
Yeah.
So they get $62.19 for transit per capita compared to the 28 cents we get in Missouri.
Yeah.
So I just when you say that, and I see that, like, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Why it's such a big gap.
Now, state of Missouri has increased its transit funding over the past couple of years. Still lags behind most of the other states, but there has been a notable improvement in that in the past few years.
Nick had a follow-up.
I am wondering about then other, especially contiguous states, so Oklahoma, Kansas, Iowa, interested in Indiana as well. Where are we in comparison to them?
So I don't have it with me, but the Missouri Public Transit Association publishes a map every year where they essentially crunch that data, and they have a map that shows Missouri and all the surrounding states and the per capita dollars. I don't have that with me. Missouri, I can say, is lower than most. I'm not sure about all of them with the recent. I know it was definitely lower than all of them up until 2 years ago. It might not be the lowest now, but it's still in kind of the lower tier of those.
Yeah, Don, and then Lisa.
Shane, if you're taking notes, another question that I have is how do we compare to the other three major metropolitan areas in Missouri?
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of funding, ridership,
funding. Yeah, what do
if
they
were
get?
To do this
right. What
for,
what do
yeah.
they get? I mean, they, you know, we're on that cusp, and what do they? What are they getting from the state? You know, as far as funding.
It's a formula of ridership and amount of service that dictates that. So, you know, St. Louis and Kansas City are getting more because they have more ridership, more annual service, et cetera. So there's a formula that dictates that.
Lisa.
That answers a large part of my question. The other one might go too deep in the weeds. Because I know in Illinois we had ballot initiatives, you know, like for the Metrolink and such, where people voted to actually, you know, for these things. Has there been anything like that in the cities that are larger than ours in Missouri for their locality?
I mean, I can speak to Kansas City. You know, Kansas City has this, the city of Kansas City, Missouri, is the only city in the Kansas City region that has a direct transit funding source. They have a sales tax that they devote to transit. None of the other cities in the Kansas City area do. Kansas City also has a transportation development district that funds the streetcars specifically.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of different models there. The rest of the cities in the area are just paying for transit out of their general fund, which is difficult for kind of the long-term sustainability of service.
Right. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Yep. So next is the operations analysis. So this is kind of diving into the specifics of the system as it operates now. So these are graphs that we like to use over the course of the study to illustrate what the service looks like over, you know, so we have weekdays, Saturdays, Sundays. The colors indicate the frequency of each route. So if you're standing at a stop, how often will a bus come by that stop? So the upper graph is, again, what we're calling the baseline service. Again, sort of the baseline of the study. How do we grow from there? The bottom graph is what you're operating now because of the combined 45-minute schedules that are now the 90-minute schedules. So just as sort of a baseline, as to get more into the presentation and recommendations, we'll kind of show how this changes over time with the recommendations. So not a, you know, this study's more focused on kind of the service planning aspects of it, the operations of service, but obviously you need to be cognizant of the fleet and facilities as well. So understanding the mix of current fleet that exists now, plans for future procurements of fleet, and then also bus stops. For example, when we're doing our near-term service planning, you know, we don't want to take service away from a stop where there's been an investment in that stop in terms of concrete improvements and shelters and benches and making sure that we're still serving those locations. And so understanding where those are, what those amenities are, and making sure that we're still serving those locations is places that are kind of maximum access for riders in the system. And then getting into ridership, so a lot of data on this page, but essentially looking at the annual ridership. I keep forgetting I have the laser thing here. So you'll see the impact of the, you know, you'll see the impact of COVID, obviously, 2020, 2021. Basically every transit agency looks like that in some form or fashion. But in 2023, you would have been going up a little higher, but those service cuts in August, and you'll see that specifically here. You'll see the impact of those cuts, and you'll see This is essentially by route. Each color route here is shown here by month, and you'll see August 2023 is the dip there. And then ridership patterns by stop. So we have data on the number of riders aboard at each stop, which obviously is an important driver of the service planning and recommendations as well.
Sean, really quick, and this is a question for Shane, probably. Shane, we made that decision because we had been doing basically forced overtime for transit drivers for a year plus. So have we stopped? You know what I mean? Are we now staffing okay so that we're not doing the forced overtime, or are we still experiencing that with our shortage?
It was 12 hours for over a year. We're at 4 hours of mandatory overtime currently with the staffing that we have. When MU's not in session, we don't dedicate those resources to Tiger Line.
You're a very quiet talker, by the way.
I'm sorry. So when MU's not in session, when we can get those resources back to us, we have that time period during the summer where we don't have to have the mandatory overtime.
Okay.
But 9 months out of the year, we've still got 4 hours of mandatory overtime.
Okay. And what's our current staffing levels right now?
We're at 30, I think. Is that right? We have 30 full-time employees, 27 CDL drivers, and 3 paratransit Class E drivers. I have 33 on the roster, but 3 of those folks are off in long-term health issues.
Okay. Yeah, Lisa.
I find it fascinating that there has not been a growth in paratransit since 2015.
There actually has been.
It's hard to tell.
The bar is just kind of so small compared to the fixed route. That actually is pretty substantial growth in paratransit. Wanting to say 20 or 30%, it's just, with the scale of this graph, it's kind of difficult to see that. But there has been a large growth in paratransit.
Thank you for clarifying that, because that does not look visually that way.
In the report, we do have some text that describes that, but
it
we could certainly add a different graphic that makes it more clear.
No, yeah. It's okay. I had read through the report, and then I was looking at that more closely and thinking, that's strange. Something's off. Thank you.
Didn't we see a growth in paratransit when we reduced the routes? I mean, that those things coincided with one another. One led to the other, correct? Yeah. We had more people asking for paratransit because they couldn't use it.
Normally, black-ride fixed route.
Fare free factors into that, too.
Yeah. So then the visioning process, goal setting, strategy, so sort of a recap of the community engagement process that led to the vision statements and really drove the service planning process. And so we talked about this a little bit earlier. We of course had our interviews with city council, other stakeholders in the community, met with the county, with the university, with a handful of other key stakeholders as well. The PTAC was really the steering committee, the process, and really kind of helped guide and review materials that ended up going to the public meeting and helped provide us with a lot of guidance along the way and input in the process. The Be Heard webpage got a lot of community comments on that as well. We did do an onboard rider survey early in the process. We got on buses and rode around and had a quick survey to ask people preferences for planning the system, also a few key attributes of their ridership, how often they ride, etc. That was helpful in us understanding the perspective of riders early on. And then we held the 3 public open house meetings over the course of the process. Around this time last year was the first one, and that was, what are ideas, challenges, issues for transit, and then met again in the spring, which was focused on, we've heard your ideas, and we hear what we've prepared based on that, what do you think? And then finally in August is sort of an affirmation of some of those draft recommendations, many of which you'll see in the report here. Asked a couple of key questions, particularly this is an exercise that we went through with PTAC, as well as in that second public open house meeting. And so this is a way of asking some key planning priority questions in a way that kind of forces people to make a decision between competing ideas of how you design the transit service. And so we asked about, which is more important to you, running buses more frequently on existing routes, or adding or extending routes to new destinations, but with less frequency, and heard a strong preference for the first one here. Should we serve as much of the city as possible or concentrate service in high ridership areas? Similar type of question, but asked a little bit different way. Got more of a roughly equal preference on that one. Add more service during peak periods, so, you know, weekdays, rush hours, et cetera, or focus more on service during off-peak periods, and saw a strong preference for that being that there's currently a lack of night service, for example, that we heard quite a bit about in that engagement. And then finally, focusing on routes that travel quickly with fewer destinations and stops, so thinking of a sort of a straight line between A and B, but that would require people to walk longer distances to get to the route. The route itself is fast, but it doesn't deviate to as many front doors and destinations. Or the opposite of that is you have a route that kind of loops around and serves front doors of where people are going, but it makes the route pretty slow end to end. And actually heard a strong, pretty strong preference for A on that one as well. So this is sort of a demonstration of the public process that we went through in the public meeting, and really an important way of us understanding what the priorities are and what people would like to see in terms of the service.
And Valerie has a question.
Yeah, I'm looking at your public meeting demonstration. How many, I guess I'm asking, how often did you do this demonstration in particular? Is this just one example, or were there several meetings with the same demonstration at each?
So we had one meeting with this. We had a couple of boards on this. So this is one of a couple of boards on this topic.
Got it.
And then we went through this exercise with the PTAC as well.
Yeah.
So we did it with the PTAC and then at that public meeting. So.
Were there several boards with the same four questions, essentially? Or similar exercise boards?
No, they changed.
Yeah, so we had this board here that was focused more on the DOT exercise, and then a couple other boards that explained these a little bit more in terms of a little more background on each of these topics.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a perspective of how much participation was there.
Oh, in terms of total numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, between the PTAC and this exercise, you know, we added up the numbers, and it, you know, again, one public meeting, one public transit advisory committee meeting. So I mean, not huge numbers, but you know, these are a lot of existing riders. You know, we met at the transit center to make sure riders could be there.
Yeah.
And we got good feedback as well. We also, among people that attended that public meeting, we had a paper survey as well. So people either used the DOTs or they gave us a paper survey where they answered the questions. So, this is an example of one of the onboard public surveys that we did. Okay. We did not get into this level of detail on those onboard surveys. Because frankly, when you're riding on a bus and talking to riders, you just don't really kind of have the time to walk through that process in a way that people can actually understand it. So it's just a bit much to try to do while somebody's riding on a bus. But we did ask a handful of questions in that survey. And really some of the key takeaways are, you know, general agreement services are more limited than we would like them to be, given the city size and transportation needs. Accordingly, you know, especially as the operations analysis, the staffing challenges, recruitment and retention is obviously a high priority. You have to have staff to operate the services. And then we heard quite a bit about current routes. While they're limited in terms of amount of service, structurally makes sense given existing resources. And so this is important in that what we did not hear was, you know, rip up the system and start over. We heard we generally like the structure of the service and the routes and where they go. They just don't run often enough. They don't run at the times that I need. And so that's an important distinction there and really kind of drove some of the recommendations. And really the two kind of key points here, and we heard this regardless of the format of input, not that these other items aren't important, but we really heard loud and clear as these being the two kind of primary issues and challenges with the service, which is routes don't run often enough, and they don't run when I need them. So it's frequency and it's service hours is really being the two driving factors. You know, other questions such as routes not travel near where I live or where I need to go, more of a question of coverage. Not that that isn't important, but we have a pretty clear clear kind of top two concerns that we heard throughout the process.
Nick, you have a question and then
So this is really of staff, and I'm wondering if you all heard anything in this that was surprising to you or that informed what you felt like you already knew to be true. I mean, I'm not surprised by these. These seem to be the things we've been concerned about all along, but I just wonder. Okay, so the things you're hearing from riders and from customers is reflective of what we're seeing here.
And it, Roy?
You made a statement that nobody said rip it up and start fresh, but what were some of the most people who ride the bus locally haven't traveled to see what some of the other bus systems are offered or transit or means of transportation in other cities, so they didn't have much to compare it to. So when given and or posing the questions, they're kind of just saying yes because based off what they know. So were there any other examples and or options presented to them that led them to say, hey, well, I kind of like this one more?
The next part of this process goes through some service concepts that we presented at the second public meeting, which gets into that some. And I can't say there was nobody that said rip up the system and start over, but that was definitely not the consensus. And we did have some people at the public meeting that had some fairly specific ideas in terms of this route should do this instead of this, and so we got some of that input as well. But yeah, here in a minute, we did do kind of a service concepts process where we presented, you know, what if you did this, and here's what it would look like on a map and a table. And so not so much comparing it to other places necessarily, just because of the differences that exist in those other places, but what if we tried this in Columbia, and a few slides from now. So accordingly, based on the feedback that we heard, really developed five vision statements. And so the first one, again, staffing. Recruitment and retention of transit staff. We have to have that to operate, maintain, and manage the system. Number two, meeting the needs of riders who need transit services the most. So focusing on those existing users really is a higher priority than expanding service to new areas and new populations. Now, some of that is needed for existing users. Existing users would like to go to different areas, too. So that doesn't completely rule out doing some expansion of the system, but really making sure that what we do is meeting the needs of the current users and people that need the system the most. And then number three, prioritizing near-term actions on improving existing services through frequency and service hours. Again, those two main frequency service hours that we keep hearing is really the two main drivers. And really making sure near-term actions, try to advance those items as much as we can, while also thinking about longer term and doing visioning about the future of the community, growth of the city, tying transit to development. So making sure we have some longer-term ideas, growth of services over time, you know, near-term, improve services for people that use it now, longer-term, how can we grow it into the future, attract even more ridership. And then lastly, take advantage of opportunities for at the county and regional level as well. A few slides later, as we get into the recommendations, I have a couple items focused on that specifically.
Exactly the same outfit.
So this is, I mentioned the questions about kind of what alternatives that we provide to people. So we did a process of defining service concepts. And so essentially what this is the second public meeting we had. They weren't recommendations. This was a what if we tried this? What if we tried that? What would it look like in Columbia? And we had four options near term, four options long term, put them on boards, did the dot exercise, did the discussion with PTAC as well. Just to get an idea of some of these broad ideas, those four kind of broad questions of would you prefer coverage or would you prefer frequency, putting that in kind of a map and table format that's more specific to Columbia. And using that as a way to figure out what the priorities really are leading into the recommendation. So the process of concepts, those concepts based on the feedback lead to the alternatives, those alternatives become recommendations is kind of the process there. Not focusing too much on this, but I do have sort of an example of this. As I mentioned, we have kind of four concepts near term, four concepts long term. not focusing much on this in this presentation because, frankly, I don't want these to be confused with recommendations. These were not recommendations. These were sort of the, this one here is what if we ran every route more frequently? What if we ran every route with existing resources, so no additional funding, no additional buses, et cetera? What if we ran every route every 30 minutes instead of every 45 minutes? So run more frequency. Well, what happens if you do that? Well, you end up having to truncate the ends of the routes. The routes can't go as far because they have to get back to the transit center and all meet up for transfers. And so you can run them more frequently, but you can't cover as much ground, and that means you're missing some of the key destinations of some of those routes, of the outer end of the routes. The opposite of that is what if we ran routes less frequently and covered more ground? What does that look like? So if we ran routes hourly instead of 45 minutes, that gives you more time for the routes to go to different places, but it means the buses aren't running as often. So a couple of examples of some of the concepts that we put out there and got thoughts on each of these and really kind of drove the thinking of our, when we get into tier one recommendations, we probably, honestly, the answer is neither of these. Neither of these really achieve what we want. And neither did the other two near-term concepts because they're all budget neutral. They're all with existing resources. Here are four different ways you could slice this system. And really what we heard is, few people had preferences one way or the other, but ultimately, we don't necessarily want that tier one to be constrained with existing resources because we don't feel like any of these really achieve what we're looking for in the near term. And so that's why when we get to the recommendations, you'll see that tier one actually has a cost attributed to it because we said, this is pointless. We'd like the best, we'd like more frequent service. But if we lose destinations because of it, why would we do that? And so that kind of what drove us to the process of that near term. The longer term, which I don't have on here, but they're in the report, we have four options there, where again, we're showing how can the system look over time, assuming additional resources. You know, so the concepts there were service hours, frequency, one that focused more on like a bus rapid transit concept. So instead of kind of pooling your resources and improving the entire system, focusing your resources more on a specific corridor or a set of corridors and establishing a high-frequency service on that, and ultimately led to the service recommendations here. So, again, this is covered more in the report than I'm covering it in here, but are there any, before I move into the recommendations, any questions on this topic?
Questions for staff or anyone?
No? All right. So getting into the draft recommendations. And so really the first thing to mention here is that this will be occurring incrementally. So we don't think it makes sense to, you know, a one-time massive huge investment in the system. It's more likely to occur over time. And so we've built in four tiers, is what we're calling it in the plan, of how you grow the service incrementally, and each tier builds on the previous tier. And that's really a function of, you know, needing to operate and maintain services on an ongoing basis that's in a sustainable way. So doing it incrementally provides a way that you can have more assurance that that's actually sustainable. You build ridership over time. You also have to allow for purchasing the capital resources necessary to do it. Vehicles are costly. They take a while to procure. They take a while to obtain federal funding for. So it takes time to buy vehicles. It takes time to upgrade facilities to house those vehicles, passenger facilities, et cetera. So a lot of those capital items take time to develop as well. And then, of course, staffing. You know, it takes time to hire and retain high-performing employees to actually operate the service. And so really kind of laying out the reasoning for each of the tiers here. And so this is the tier one, and so essentially what we ended up here, so no changes to the route alignments in this tier. That happens later. Beginning service a little bit earlier in the morning at Wabash, but primarily the change here is adding service later into the evening on weekdays and on Saturdays as well, using those combined 90-minute routes. So essentially, the 45-minute routes running during the day as they do now, but tacking on 90-minute service in the evening and on Saturdays. And you'll see the changes in the graph here with the baseline baseline service hours, you'll notice the tier one shows the later service hours, and then adding that 90-minute evening service on weekdays and Saturdays.
Michelle, I think Nick has a question.
Yeah, I know we hear this sometime that we need evening hours and we need weekend hours. Do we have any data from your work that supports that?
Yeah, so there's, of course, not existing service now in Columbia to be able to get numbers on that, but we did learn from some peer agencies that do have evening service, particularly in college communities, that do quite well. So really relying on data and information from those peer agencies that we talked about earlier.
I mean, one of the things we hear about is people getting to and from work, especially if they work past the time when our routes are no longer running. So.
Now, the demand isn't as high as it is in weekdays, so that's why the 90-minute service instead of the 45, eventually improving those frequencies in later tiers. So you don't see as much ridership, but I think definitely some demand for at least some services at that time.
And Sean, can you expand a little bit about when that sort of shift happens from the 45-minute to the 90-minute? Is it just for that 6:40 to 10:25 that's the recommended? Okay.
So about 6:30 p.m. is when that switchover.
And then looking at the table that you have with the peer agencies in here, do theirs also have that it changes at the evening hours, or do theirs run on their 30-minute, 60-minute, whatever their normal schedule was?
Most of them have less service in those off-peak hours than the daytime hours, and that's with most transit agencies in general.
Okay.
And that tracks with most of the peers there.
Okay, and I think Lisa has a question.
Does anybody offer Sunday service at all from some of the other agencies?
Some, I'd say.
Retail, and they work, in restaurants on Sundays too.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just find that strange that there's just one day in particular that.
Yeah, the later tiers will get there. But in terms of the other peers, off the top of my head, most of them do, but not quite all of them that are.
You've got Athens, Georgia, yeah. Lafayette, Indiana, and Urbana, Illinois are the only ones that do. All the rest of them.
Yeah, that table's in the report. I don't have that in here, but there are most, yeah.
There's no page number, so I can't tell you what page number it is.
they're just light.
Okay.
I debated on just having the report itself on the screen here and walking through it, but ended up going with a lot. Different format, but it's there is a page that has a table on it that calls out the service of each of the tiers. Yeah.
Actually did a fairly good job.
So later in the presentation is where I have a cost estimate slide later here, but before we get there, I will mention essentially the cost of the tier one, and this includes the impact on paratransit services. I don't think I mentioned that. So because of the extended hours, you're expanding hours of paratransit as well. So when we get into cost estimates here, it's not just for the fixed route service, but it's also for paratransit. So for this tier one, and again, there's a full table later in here, but the tier one, about $1.4 million a year is the annual operating cost of this tier one expansion, inclusive of the paratransit. So the tier two is where we take a bit of a bigger step towards implementing the vision. And so this was actually not initially a tier that we had in the first draft of the plan. We had three tiers, and this is essentially the one that was added. And the reason it was added is because we had a pretty big jump in cost between what was then tier one and tier two. And we needed to find sort of a middle step between those tiers, and that's what this is. And it is sort of a half step, and there are some kind of negative impacts with that half step. Overall, it's a large increase in service and good for the system, and will drive ridership growth, but because it's only sort of a half step to tier three, there are a few drawbacks to it. So essentially what this does is it takes three of the existing six routes and upgrades the free, it essentially adds a bus to three of those routes. It allows you to run those routes more often, so they can run every 30 minutes instead of every 45. And on those three routes, you can actually extend them a little bit further too, because by virtue of adding a second bus to those routes, you not only improve the frequency, but you can give yourself a little extra time to spend where those buses can serve some new destinations. So example, on the red route here, we're showing it extending west here to some of the new development over on Scott Boulevard, and then to the east here, an extension on East Broadway, and then a bit of a bigger loop up here on Orange Route that serves some additional destinations to the north. So that's kind of what Tier 2 is. Paratransit impact, so there's a more of a moderate increase to the paratransit service area. The federally required paratransit service area, so that 3/4 of a mile within fixed routes, because you are extending these routes to new areas, so you have a bit of a larger paratransit service area. The negative impact here, when you do this for only 3 of the 6 routes, it means the routes will no longer, every trip will no longer line up at Wabash. So right now, every route runs in the same frequency. Every bus, they all meet up at Wabash. People make transfers, and they all leave at the same time. So if you make this change, while you get the benefit of improved frequency on your highest ridership routes, you're going to have some, but you're essentially going to have a 15-minute stagger between some of those routes at Wabash. So some people that are used to making a transfer now, stepping off one bus and onto another bus, they might be having to wait 15 minutes to get on the next bus. So that is an impact to mention here. But again, it's sort of the reason why we didn't tackle frequency in Tier 1 is because improving frequency on all the routes kind of right off the bat doubles the cost of the service. You're essentially adding a second bus to every route. So your baseline is you're doubling the cost no matter what you do. And so that's why the Tier 1, we're focusing more on the service hours, because you can increase those in more of an incremental way. And then the Tier 2 is sort of a half step to the frequency improvement. So it's a bit of an awkward tier, to be honest, but if we're thinking about this incrementally and how we can do this over time with smaller steps, it's a way to go about doing that.
Do our other peer cities have situations where they stagger those? Because this is a surprise to me, because in the larger cities where I've used transit, they were all staggered, but
like the hub and spoke system,
where that's possible, is that more common?
It's pretty. You know, the more routes you have, and the more connection points. So the system right now essentially has one connecting point. A lot of services, there are multiple points where they connect throughout the system, and as a scheduler, it's impractical to make the buses all line up. So you do see staggering in most other systems.
Even in systems our size with our peer cities?
It's a bit of a mixed bag there. This is what's called a pulse system.
Yeah.
So, you know, buses, they all leave at the same time, they all come back at the same time. It's called a pulse. Some of the services are like that, some of them are not. Manhattan, Kansas comes to mind. They're another one of our clients. They don't really have a central location at all, so none of the schedules are really coordinated with each other. So that's a bit different. Some of them do have more of this service where there's a central location, but most of them don't have the case where every route in the system does this. Yeah. They might have a few routes that have time transfers, but other routes just come and go as they are. So it's a bit of a mixed bag in that regard. Yeah.
So in this, and I don't remember if you were all around at that time too with us, but like we had, you know, we tried to do a different system where we did more of the radial out, and we saw a major drop in ridership. So we went back to what was the hub and spoke system, like not necessarily pulse. That sounds
nicer. It's essentially the same thing.
So I think Roy was kind of wondering, like, did we look into that sort of system? But it sounds like from your feedback from community engagement was like, just fix this for now, and then let us envision maybe a future.
Yeah, and one reason why I think this is significant to point out. While other cities do have more staggered schedules, we actually, at the very outset of the project, what do you like about the system? What do you not like about the system? In the like category, we're quite a bit about, we like the fact that the buses all meet up at the same time at Wabash, and I can transfer between any route I want. And so we heard that as a feature that people like about the system now. So it is notable if we do change that, because that is changing something about the system that existing riders like.
Am I also correct that this the tier suggestions, like these kind of tweaks, don't have as many then of the requirements of the planning that from the federal government. That because I remember when we did the radial system, we had a plan for a lot longer of engagement with the federal government for community engagement coming back, because like we had to be very, or is this, would any changes to this take as long of time to implement, regardless of funding?
That's probably Title VI related, as I'm guessing.
I think it was something, basically how we talk to the community more.
Now, the process is similar. Now, when you are looking at more of a radial system or a system that adds more routes and new locations, it is a more of a difficult analysis process to basically make sure that you're meeting your Title VI plan. I wouldn't say that time difference is huge, though.
Okay.
Yeah, from the federal compliance standpoint, at least.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Your question. So this system is great, but it does have some flaws. Like when I took the time to ride the bus, the one time that I did, it had a lot of handicaps and bikes. So the bus that I was on was late, or really close to being late. So when it was time to transfer, it was like 1 minute, 2 minutes before the buses were all leaving, and I didn't know exactly which bus to get on. So it was like a scramble and a scatter. Like, I was like, oh. So, yes, it's great when they're all leaving at one time, but sometimes it's like chaos.
Yeah.
The systems I used that had staggers were affected by the same problems, too.
Right. Yeah, but
if anything, it was more chaotic because there was a stagger and a chaos.
Panic. Yeah, I think there's going to be drawbacks with any of them, right? Just we would all like to be efficient on running. But I think it's good to know. I think when you mentioned that 15-minute kind of gap, that actually makes some people more comfortable because it gives a little bit extra time to catch the next bus. So I think everybody can have their picks and chooses.
There's a trade-off on this one. You have shorter route or shorter routes. So sorry.
Three of them.
By virtue of adding a second bus to the route, it gives you a little more cushion in the schedule to be able to account for wheelchair boardings and things like that.
Yeah.
So that's having a second bus does help with those sorts of things. It helps with reliability.
Will we hold for someone who is getting a wheelchair off a bus and transferring to another bus, given that they arrive at the same time?
There's a gap.
Essentially a 5-minute gap, but it could extend, depending on
the buses. But we'd have to know that they were headed to that bus, too.
Yeah, so it's tricky.
It's tight now.
Kind of got a scatter system.
Yeah.
I believe that's the point I really was making.
So before we get to that cost slide, I'll go ahead and mention, essentially, the cost impact of this compared to Tier 1, $2.6 million between this and Tier 1. And so that'd be essentially $4 million from the baseline service. And you'll see that's most directly tied to this column here, annual vehicle revenue hours. So the amount of service that you're operating in a year, that's essentially the costs are based on those numbers there. So Tier 3 essentially completes that. Tier 2 is the half step. Tier 3 is essentially the full step, where you take the entire system, the rest of the routes, and you take everything to that 30-minute frequency. And also improving the frequency on Saturdays to 60 minutes. And then this is the step where adding Sunday service. So we had that comment earlier, and so this is where we bring in 7:30 a.m. to about 6:30 p.m., adding Sunday service, running hourly headways in the system. And so this does have a pretty significant paratransit impact. You're adding Sunday, and you're adding a bit more service area on some of the other routes as well. So you'll see your numbers are getting pretty big in terms of the vehicle revenue hours there, but you're having 7-day-a-week service, and you're having that 30-minute frequency during the weekdays and 60-minute off. So this is a step up from Tier 2 to Tier 3, about $3.3 million annual operating cost, and so that's 7.3 from baseline to Tier 3 in total.
I've got Roy and then Don.
Yep.
Okay. This is the only route that adds any additional transit to Route B to where the factories are, which is high. Well, I think that we could have high ridership if it went out that more and more people could apply for more jobs out that way. And this being the highest one, did we think about adding that exact same route to some of the other, one of the other two options?
You certainly could. It's a higher cost. You know, what we're trying to do is kind of grow it incrementally. You could certainly add, and thanks for mentioning that. I completely forgot to point out that this is also the tier where you add a new route along Paris Road, Route D, again, to some of those industrial employers up to the northeast, but also looping around to serve some of the residential areas up there too. So thanks for mentioning that. I forgot to mention that. But again, just a cost consideration with you know, you could certainly add that to tier two, but you know, that number does increase there. So that's really good.
And the tiers build on each other. Yeah. So you know, so if you were adding that in tier three, if you added it in tier two, it'll change the costs around some and change the resources around some. But it is they aren't options, they're tiers growing towards the end.
Understanding that those are tiers, but it's such a high demand for Route B. Or thinking of some extended service, like noticing that it only goes to Whitegate, and then, but we still have all those other things at the end of Paris Road or Route B that aren't being connected.
Yeah.
So what type of connection system are we going to make sure or ensure? Because we want this to be a more robust system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the other way to do it would be to, in tier two, you don't make the frequency improvements, but instead you add that route. So you keep running all the other routes at 45 minutes, and you add this route. Now, we think based on the feedback that we heard, the frequency is more important, but that's, you could build a different tier two that makes that trade-off.
Yeah. All right, we've got Don and then Valerie.
How far up Route B does the new route go? I'm not clear. I know you see 760 or 63 where it crosses, but how far up does it go? How far north? What is that intersection there at the north end?
Blanking on the name of that street. Apologies, I don't have the.
Is that up there? It used to be Catfish Corner and that area, or a little further up? I know there was a restaurant up there one time.
I think it's. It looks like that restaurant.
So it's just
north.
Northeast of Waco.
It Waco is now.
The
there
road
used to be one
dead
of
ends okay. there.
Yeah.
Right before it turns around. I can't think of what's
before Brown Station.
Like that little curve at the top right is Peabody. That's our landfill. So basically, it's just south of the landfill.
This is Waco Road.
Okay.
I was like, I know what
Waco
Peabody
road, okay.
looks like.
Yeah. Thank you.
And that's fine.
Yeah, sorry.
Waco's
yeah.
where Aurora and correct.
Right, but then, yeah, but then.
Back up to the top.
Do we want to go even if when we get here, maybe even go further up, because it's like Roy said, that's our major development, manufacturing, our industrial corridor, if you will.
It's right there before.
Potentially, you know, there is a limit to being able to do it with a single bus, right? If you go too far, you have to add another bus, you're doubling the cost of the route. So just trying to be cognizant of, you know, when we're building this, making sure the mileage works out to where a bus can get from Wabash, do all this stuff, and get back to Wabash within an hour.
Valerie, did you have a question?
Yeah, can you remind me, you had participants that by far and large favor frequency. What percentage of the participants who took the survey were already riders?
So this was an onboard survey there. All
yeah,
there.
Okay. So yes. All of them.
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder if we're reaching the people who would use this, but don't because they
fair.
Don't have
yeah.
the route. And I actually do hear from a lot of people who get rides from friends out there because they're non-drivers.
Well, isn't that predominantly where first last mile goes?
Yeah, that was the intent behind a lot of that. And the other thing was is that, you know, we used to have a route, but it was the timing, right? So when you talk about service hours, it used to not meet the third shift for some of the factories up there. And so with expanding the service hours, I think the question would be for them, are we meeting more of your employees' times, or are we still missing a large percentage because of it ending early, or is that late, is 10:25 late enough to actually capture that? Yeah. I assume from here I'm viewing this as also a baseline,
yeah.
And we're going to continue to ask questions and get more feedback from stakeholders and like actually any sort of recommendations we do going forward.
Yeah, we talked about early on was the time has to expand before you go out Route B.
Exactly.
Because if there's anybody that's going to ride the bus, I would think the first ones would be like your third shift employees, right? And so you've got to expand that time before you add that route. How quickly you get there depends on resources, of course.
But this is also kind of one of those routes that could be an exceptional route because, like, depending on when hours of when you clock it in and different things, when shift changes. Mm-hmm. So this could be one of those special routes where even if all the other ones are operating on this time schedule, this one can operate on a different.
And I agree, but if I can pick them up on third shift and bring them back to Wabash, I've got no other bus to take them home. So I've got to run all the routes in order to be able to take people mm-hmm. to work and get them home.
And that's where First West Mile could also connect.
Yeah.
So there's a way.
Is there any restrictions on the, since we get, you know, so much of our funding from the federal government, and when you talk about Title VI and some of the requirements with this, is there any restrictions on you run your whole system or you just run part of your system for some of those extended hours?
Not really. I mean, essentially, from a Title VI standpoint, you basically have to show that you're not providing a lesser level of service to minority areas, is essentially what the Title VI analysis comes down to. So as long as you satisfy that, there's no real restrictions on.
So it might be an analysis that we have to do to see whether or not if we were to do, you know what I mean, in partnership with one of our other partners like First Last Mile or something, whether or not we're still meeting that requirement. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, Nick.
In this regard, I'm going to jump a little bit because in Tier 4, you include that area up there along with one southeast and one southwest. And I think from reading the report, the idea might be to do these in a micro-transit kind of way, correct?
Potentially, yeah.
So aren't we sort of already, I'm not sure how robust first last mile is, but we're kind of doing that already, are we not? In the up Paris Road in particular with them?
We would have to hear from First.
I'm not sure. Is that happening?
I'm just wondering what that might teach us about where we do it in other places, but as well as that one, because it seems, you know, we're really concerned about the manufacturing up that way, those major manufacturers. So those don't, I can imagine that buses going that way could be very, very well used at some times of the day and then just barely used at all at other parts, times of the day. So whether or not microtransit might not be a way to address that, even on Tier 3, but we can sort of take this apart and put it back together as we determine, right? But,
Do you want to tell us about Tier 4 now?
Yeah, so this is Tier 4. The idea here is to present the kind of the long-range vision for what we think satisfies the purpose and need of the input that we're hearing throughout the process. And so the idea here is to fill out the system with establishing high-frequent corridors. So this isn't any sort of official designation, but sort of rule of thumb in the transit industry. Mm-hmm. 15-minute service is a high-frequency service. So it tends to be, through research, the level of service where you don't have to build your life around a bus schedule. So if you're relying on a route that comes once an hour, think about how much you're having to adjust your daily life based on the schedule of that route. Whereas if you get to the point of having 15-minute frequent service or better, really just kind of go to the stop and you'll never have that long of a wait. And it gives you a lot more freedom to kind of live your life and use transit to get to where you need to go and not necessarily organize your life around a bus schedule. And so establishing sort of a east-west and a north-south frequent corridors where you run 15-minute service on weekdays, that's what this is here, on those kind of key north-south, east-west corridors. And then filling in the gaps in the system, so we've already added the Paris Road route through the Tier 1, but looking at the southwest and southeast quadrants of the city as well. Now, the next slide, which we'll talk about, gets into these could potentially be microtransit, especially in some of these areas here. Here I'm showing them as fixed routes, but could potentially be deployed as paratransit zones as well. Cost-wise, there's not necessarily a huge difference between those two, and we'll talk about pros and cons of microtransit. But that's essentially kind of the main item we're doing in the Tier 4 is giving the frequent transit corridors, running everything seven days a week, filling in gaps in the system with some new routes. You're also improving 15-minute service during the day. Weekdays, you're making that 30 minutes on Saturdays. So you're, again, incrementally getting to higher frequency service in the system. Cost impact of the Tier 4, this, you have quite a bit of a bigger jump here. So from Tier 3 to 4, $7.5 million annual operating cost. And so that's $14.8 million from baseline to Tier 4. The impact there. Now, microtransit. So you'll notice that Tier 1, you know, the earlier tiers not really getting into microtransit. And so really the reason for that is the pros of microtransit, flexibility, being able to schedule a service to kind of door-to-door service, essentially. So the flexibility of that service and the coverage. You can establish a zone of coverage as opposed to a fixed route where people have to go to an established stop on that route. So those are the benefits of microtransit. The most significant downside is capacity. So a microtransit service, really only able to move 2 to 3 riders per hour in a microtransit service, whereas the existing fixed routes in Columbia are more in the range of 10 riders a service hour. It varies by route, varies by time of day, but essentially you can move a lot fewer people with a microtransit service. And for a pretty similar cost, because your cost is mostly labor. You're paying someone to drive the vehicle, really regardless of the type of vehicle that it is. And so, had we heard more loud and clear that coverage is a top goal, not that it isn't important, we certainly have people citing that as something they'd like to see, but it didn't really come out in those kind of top two priorities. Had we heard it as more loud and clear as a high priority, microtransit would have been more in the factor of the kind of Tier 1, Tier 2 recommendations as opposed to improving the fixed route services. But again, we think as an additive to the system in the long term, assuming more funding, more resources, particularly those new southwest and southeast routes would be locations where instead of seeing the lines on the map, you could essentially draw a zone in that quadrant of the city and establish that as microtransit. Frankly, ridership demand at that point, when you get to that point in your tier four, will kind of drive that decision. But essentially, for a roughly similar cost, can be deployed either way there.
Chuck, can you give some examples of other communities that have microtransit? And what is it, the similar sort of, it's a bus or is it a van? You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
This is usually
a smaller vehicle, a van in most cases, like a Ford Transit in a lot of cases, a minivan in some cases. So those are typically the two types of vehicles that mm-hmm. are used for microtransit.
And what other communities have microtransit?
So most familiar, Kansas City has quite a bit of microtransit service. The city of Kansas City, Missouri actually has recently established a citywide microtransit service they call IRIS. Johnson County, Kansas has microtransit. Wyandotte County has microtransit. St. Louis Metro has some microtransit zones as well. So there are quite a few communities that do it.
Any with more of a density similar to Columbia? Because both of those, or all of those, sound a little bit more dense.
Yeah, again, a few of the peers, and I don't think there's a table in the report that talks about microtransit with peers. A few of the peers do have microtransit. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure which ones. I don't think most of them do, but a couple of them do have microtransit services with those peers, yeah.
Okay.
And so the microtransit is really best deployed. You see it usually as a gap filler of fixed route service, places that are difficult to serve with a fixed route bus, either we don't have quite enough demand for ridership to warrant the larger vehicles and frequent service, or some, you know, the street network is difficult for a big bus to get through places like, you know, usually your lower density development patterns are places where microtransit is deployed because, again, moving two riders an hour compared to 10 riders. So this is kind of what it looks like all put together here. I know these graphs are in the plan as well. Kind of hard to read up here, but essentially showing the growth over time. I will point out that this is a mistake right here. These should be 90-minute service with the purple there, so the baseline there. So that's a mistake there. We'll correct. But essentially showing how the services grow over time. Tier one, you're adding the evening, more Saturday hours. Tier two, you're establishing that higher frequent service in the green, that means 30 minutes, and then 60 minutes on Saturday. Tier three, adding a new route in the what we're calling purple route, essentially the Paris Road Route B, establishing new Sunday. And then in tier four with the red, you're seeing that 15-minute frequency pop up on the key corridors there. And then, so switching gears, just, you know, something that we did, you know, talk about early in the process, get some feedback on. And so this is not built into any of the tiers specifically. It's sort of a separate standalone item. It's something that's in the report as an idea, as a concept that could be developed at some point in the future. It's an idea of regional service, essentially connecting Columbia to Jefferson City. And so building, essentially, how could this look? What would this look like? How much would it cost? So what we've done in draft form in the report is looking at what would it look like to have like six daily round trips Columbia to Jefferson City. And so connecting from Wabash, stopping at the airport, stopping at Ashland, and then down to Jefferson City, connecting to some of the state office buildings, and then eventually to the Amtrak and the Greyhound station as well, which those are actually important connections with the potential of this source of funding, which is essentially for intercity services. So making a connection to Amtrak, to Greyhound are important to the future potential of being able to get some of that funding. And it's kind of drives some of the schedule as well, making sure those services line up. So again, does it have to be? I will mention here, MoDOT actually did a survey that kind of led us to this conclusion and some of the schedules that we built in terms of demand for such a service. And that's kind of what we used as a baseline to build this. Now, you could build a schedule with four daily trips, or you could change that number. But based on that survey, and based on that survey included people responding to what time of day would they be most likely to ride. So we've kind of based this schedule based on the results of that survey and why we ended up with this. But it's certainly scalable to some extent in terms of the number of trips and the cost. And this comes out to about $600,000 a year if you were to operate a schedule like this. So again, this is not included in any of those tiers. It's sort of a standalone item, but we wanted to, because it's something we did hear about. Again, not the first and foremost highest priority that people talked about, but did get some comments and questions in this regard, so giving an idea and a concept of what this could potentially look like. So those are the recommendations. I have a few slides here kind of focused on implementation, but the recommendations are kind of the bulk of this. So are there any other questions before I cover the last couple items here?
All right. Come back to it if we do.
So this is, I've been mentioning kind of the costs as we go along, but this is what it looks like all put together. And these are cumulative, so the costs each build on each tier. So I mentioned that tier one is $1.4 million, so that's essentially the difference there. These numbers do not include Tiger Line. I've kind of left Tiger Line out of this for purposes of just illustrating what the cost would be of the GoComo services. Essentially, assuming Tiger Line will continue running as it is for purposes of cost estimates, but just kind of what it looks like in terms of the fixed route cost and the paratransit impact as well.
I had a question about that, actually.
Yeah.
In any of the analysis, did any sort of absorption over the routes on campus come into play with any of the different tiers? Especially when you get to, some of the ones that have, the 15-minute goal, the 15-minute one, where then that kind of aligns more with the hours of Tiger Line and their expectations.
Yeah, I think that gives you a ton of potential for more ridership, particularly along here.
Yeah.
On the north-south, and then even connecting up to the east-west as well. So, yeah, that was a component of why, in particular this stretch here, I think, is where you really see that 15-minute service.
Well, because I think the conversation is around, because we have those contracts, we've obligated drivers to that area, so we can't do a lot of expansion until we have more drivers to share with the other routes. So then, any of the sort of, would it be possible to incorporate, once we renegotiate with the university or others, about almost when we do this tier, those will also include the Tiger Line routes because now students will be riding with employees and whoever else.
Now, one of the things that this does not really accomplish with regard to Tiger Line is it's not providing the sort of parking lot shuttle to the university that a lot of...
They would probably like to get out of the business of being a long-term parking storage.
Yeah. So there would still maybe be a need for that type of service in addition to this because, we're not recommending changing the alignment of this route to serve that particular need.
Okay.
And then we do have some capital cost estimates here. I haven't focused as much on that aspect of it, but that's, of course, an important component to it as well. Part of the thinking behind the Tier 1 is to essentially do that in a way where you're not having a significant capital cost impact because it allows you to do it sooner. It takes a while to purchase a bus, for example. Essentially, all we're showing in Tier 1 in terms of capital impact is an additional paratransit vehicle that might be needed because of that expanded paratransit service, but essentially little to no capital cost in that Tier 1. That obviously comes a lot more into play Tier 2 and beyond because you need more vehicles. So in the Tier 2, you need three additional vehicles in peak service, one more for paratransit, so four more total in terms of peak vehicles, and actually a couple more on top of that because of the spares that are required as well. So that's the biggest component of this cost. We did integrate with this cost the replacement of existing vehicles that have reached their useful life based on the current makeup of the fleet, so making sure that we're accounting for those costs as well. So we have replacement of vehicles. We have additional buses needed to meet each of the tiers. Capital costs of additional bus stop improvements, for example, and then facilities. And then on the facility side of things, you have the RAISE project that will improve the maintenance and storage facility. So facilities costs are really more related to upgrades to Wabash to accommodate additional passenger facilities and to accommodate additional administrative staff as well. So that's kind of what the facilities numbers are showing. So that's kind of what you end up with. And these are costs of implementing each tier. These are not cumulative as in the same way that the operating costs are, because those are annual costs, and this is essentially the cost of each tier. Funding, so there are no recommendations funding-wise on this slide or in the report. This is more of a description of sources that are out there, many of which you're utilizing now in terms of federal, state, local. Because the study, we did not do a survey or poll of residents on how they would feel about different funding options, for example. And so not having done that, don't really feel confident in this report kind of saying what you should do, because you'll want to do some of that evaluation and analysis before you arrive at those decisions. Just kind of walking through existing sources that fund transit, Some of them apply here, some of them not yet used here, transportation development districts, for example. I mentioned that earlier, that's the funding source of Kansas City Streetcar, for example. Essentially build a district around that investment that funds the operations of that service. There's something called transportation management associations, which are essentially private employers that can band together and fund improvements to transportation of all types, sometimes used for transit, sometimes not. There aren't a ton of examples of these. The ones that do exist tend to be more in, like Dallas, for example, has an MTMA, so they tend to be in larger cities. In theory, it's an option here. You get enough employers, say employers along the Paris Road Route B corridor, that this is important enough to them where they want to pull together some resources and assist with funding transit service is theoretically an option.
Kind of like the model that the First Last Mile is thinking of, yeah, as far as that partnership. Nick, did you have a question?
Well, this seems to be a good place to ask it. Did you look at all at fares and the possibility of reintroducing fares?
So we do have a section in the report dedicated to fares, more from the standpoint of the fare recovery ratio that could be expected based on historical numbers. And if memory serves, it's around, you know, the fare revenue could expect to pay for about 10% of the service if you were to reinstate fares. Now, our study did not include the engagement and surveys, et cetera, specific to fares.
I know there's a cost to reintroducing them.
Sure.
So there's a trade-off on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fare boxes, staffing manager, et cetera. Yeah. So there is a staffing component of this, and Shane, Mike, feel free to jump in if you feel like you need to here. But I do want to mention that the plan does include, obviously, we need to account for the additional staff that would be needed for each tier. So those numbers are in the plan. Also, looking at how the department could be restructured, both to improve efficiency and to prepare for future growth. And so looking at ways to add, essentially have superintendent positions that oversee portions of the service, portions of the department, in a way that can operate a bit more efficiently than the current structure, especially considering if at some point we get to numbers like this, we'll need to reorganize to have a kind of a different management reporting structure for the service. Shane, Mike, anything to add here on this? I know you guys have had some discussion already on this topic.
The one thing I think I would tell you is when we have a triennial kind of audit that gets done, and when you go through that process, you really start to look at how other transit agencies are set up, and some of the ones that are the most successful are much more set up as that future organizational chart has shown. So, and really it's just setting that base so that as you grow, you're able to, you know, it's kind of like grow that hierarchy the way that, way that you want to. That's really it.
Can I clarify too, Chuck?
Yeah.
In the estimated like cost estimates for the different tiers, those are incorporating these additional staffing, correct?
And the
capital.
Yeah, that's,
so it's like everything, right?
The staffing is the majority of the operating cost.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just trying to remember if our four that we added this year got us to tier one, but apparently not. So thank you for that. But it's close as far as the staffing numbers, not the capital outlays needed.
There's a real jump in, just look at you can see it, but the driver numbers from tier one to tier two.
Yeah.
You know, and we're having trouble hiring drivers. And,
right.
You know, there's a whole conversation to be had here about known funding moving forward, funding you can count on in order to be able to implement this, but that doesn't necessarily directly result in additional drivers. You know?
And this was the question I have more for your experience with other transit agencies. I'm assuming that we're not unique in struggling to hire bus drivers. I think
definitely not unique. Probably more of an acute problem here than it is in a lot of cases, but every agency in some form or fashion is dealing with the same issue.
Have you noticed any sort of innovative or not innovative, but we're just not doing, ways that they're doing for recruitment or retention? Or I think one of the questions I had is also about the use of like part-time And I get this 100% because somebody once was like, well, what about Walmart greeters? You know, retirees who just want to hang out with people all day. Like, are you seeing any sort of creative ways that people are increasing staffing
for driving? Yeah. I mean, like, when you go to transit conferences, there's usually a session these days on recruitment and retention. And so you hear of places that, you know, signing bonuses. Of course, the number one factor is wages, right? You increase wages. That's your number one way to increase the number of drivers. But there's signing bonuses. There are some places that invested in different, just like, amenities and facilities for their employees, things of that nature. Now, I can't necessarily say there's a great, like, kind of peer-reviewed data or analysis of how well those things have done, because, again, this is really a problem that's, I mean, staffing is always a challenge of transit and always has been, but it's been really in the past 3 years that it's been such a major issue. So there's not a ton of research on sort of what has worked and what hasn't. I know wages have been increased for drivers, and I think that's led to some improvement in numbers currently, but that's really the kind of the number one thing. You know, but even then, you're competing with school bus operators and trucking, and et cetera. So.
I would tell you that the class and compensation study.
You are such a quiet talker.
I know, I'm sorry. My voice is shot. What we're seeing is we're seeing applicants. We are getting applicants. We are interviewing applicants. What we see, though, is there's some that can't get through the medical requirements to drive a bus. There's some that come on board and don't want to do that job. So it's hire a few, lose a couple, And so it there for a while, we weren't getting applicants at all. Mm-hmm. And so the class and comp has changed that. We're interviewing people. It's just finding enough people in Columbia, Missouri that want to do that job. And it isn't only that, it's now that we've combined routes, the last thing I want to do is uncombine routes and then lose 4 or 5 people and be right back in the spot I was in before. So even when we get staffed up, I need to see that staying power, before I would recommend that we uncombine routes. And that's really the
What is that magic number for you?
I think you need...
Because Dave gave it to us for trash and recycling, so what's yours?
Well, I would tell you need for about 6 months, you need to see steady numbers.
At
what? About 40, which is about, the reason I asked for 4 more was to get to 40.
And we're at 30?
We're at 30, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. And we've been as high as 34, 35, 36, and I'm back down at 30. Okay. So it's a lot of this right now. And so, when MU's not in session, I gain some drivers back. So that's a good time to make that change if we were consistently there for a while, because I'd have that cushion, of those 3 months. But we're at a stage now where I probably can't recommend that coming up in May, just based on those numbers.
Valerie has a thing, but I have a quick clarification on that. You mentioned, Mike, that 33 on the book. How many is our... current listed as capacity, how many numbers of drivers, if we could get all the applicants and they were there, how many can we officially employ?
40.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you want to be 100% employed before you uncombine routes? Is that a realistic? Never mind. I'm sorry.
That sounds pretty realistic.
I know. I was just kind of like, whoa.
There's a whole lot of in between there.
Yeah.
I've got 4 hours of mandatory overtime right now.
Right.
You can bump that back up. See what I mean? Like, yeah. We were running 12 for over a year.
I was just
so there's all kinds of nuance there.
Okay. Valerie, yeah.
Yeah. A while back, Barbara brought up the concept of an ambassador program. Where are we on that? Is that something that's still being considered? Is there any progress?
We didn't put the funding in. We didn't end up making that amendment to it. We prioritized the drivers over it.
Prioritize the drivers. The reason I bring it up, I've had a few conversations with drivers recently, just random meetings, actually, and it sounded to me from their experiences and the reasons why they didn't want to stay in the job, an ambassador-type program would help that as well, and that might be somewhere to, put somebody who maybe wouldn't have met the medical requirements for a driver.
That could be a thing. Do you see anything? This is idea that we don't know if it's anywhere else or if we just made this up. But the idea is that somebody else is riding the bus too, like another employee is riding the bus too, and can kind of serve as that guidance as like what route, what bus you need to catch next, or also just be another person so that the driver can focus on driving.
Right.
And they can focus on it if anything else comes up on
like
the bus.
It's like a transit ambassador thing.
Yep.
Yeah, there are some, there are some places that,
I just don't want to say bus monitor.
You don't
want to
say bus monitor?
Bus.
Yeah, I like the transit.
Ambassador sounds better. Yeah, do you see any of that?
Some, but, you know, most places you might have a few for a large system, and so you don't necessarily see them a lot. I'm not aware of a place that, you know, would be able to have one for, like, each bus or each route or anything.
Yeah.
A large bus system in a big city that's a standalone transit authority has their own police officers.
Yeah.
See what I mean? And so they might not be somebody on every bus, but there's somebody that is dedicated to exactly what you're talking about.
If there's like a an area that okay.
And I felt like what Valerie was saying, I've heard a similar thing about the safety of the bus driver and the safety of the riders being, a shared concern there, because in like around the Idaho area and some other areas, there's a lot of senior citizens who would like to ride the bus more, but they don't feel safe riding the bus right now. Just sharing that, and the licensure that's required to drive one of those larger buses, and then we're required to buy, as I learned from Shane, we're required to buy the bus the size that they are because of federal requirements, because of how we use the grant. Because if they were smaller, some drivers wouldn't be required to have to go through the hoops for those additional licensures. So I've heard about that challenge as well from the people who drive, not from and the people who have shared that they weren't the people who were consulted for this, because really as riders. But there is a fair amount of people out there, I think, that would actually want to ride the bus, and I don't think that we have their information as part of the survey. But I've heard it from senior citizens as well as, younger folks as well.
Can I ask a quick question? Did we ask transit questions on the citizen survey? I don't know, Brian, do you remember if we asked transit questions?
There's a couple.
Okay. Just kind of, wondering if maybe the next time, kind of asking that.
I don't think it gets into the philosophy.
What's more, would you ride the bus, is the question that I was wondering. Yeah. You know what I mean? If it came conveniently, would you want to ride the bus? No.
I think it'd be helpful to know.
No. Okay. I don't know what your last slide is.
I think I've got maybe a couple away.
That's
I've got maybe two left here, so we're almost done here. So just a
You've been very patient with us interrupting that. I appreciate that. Thank you.
So just to kind of briefly mention the importance of tying transit to land use policy. And so you have an existing comprehensive plan. Some of this is taken from that comprehensive plan combined with kind of research and ideas for transit and land use coordination. The comprehensive plan has this idea of a growth priority areas that defines an area to prioritize for infill development. And essentially, the long story short here is that as a community expands geographically in a low density pattern, transit just can't keep up with that. And so really making sure that your development policy is in a way that you can actually build up the city and transit can actually essentially have more people living in close proximity to transit and their destinations are in close proximity to transit as well. And so transit-oriented development, for example, the 15-minute level of service are the types of corridors where you can have development where people rely on transit and don't necessarily need to own cars to be able to get around. And so you have an existing comprehensive plan that has a lot of this in it already. My understanding is that city development process is already looking at transit as when they're reviewing developments and site plans and things of that nature, which is great. So just reiterating the importance of when you do update your comprehensive plan at some point, that it's incorporating many of these strategies and making sure transit is at the forefront of that. And then lastly, an implementation matrix. Frankly, I've struggled a little bit with kind of how to talk about this and show this, kind of workshop this a little bit with the PTAC. The idea being to show a little more detail in an idea of what it might take time-wise to implement the tier one, and then giving some kind of general time frames for the outer tiers. You know, it's hard to pin down how long will it take to do tier four. There are so many factors associated with it, but in terms of these building on each other and developing that ridership base and the capital resources that would be necessary for that, at least giving some guidance in terms of general timeframes there. So it's kind of what we ended up with on the implementation matrix. And that's really all I have, my contact information. So feel free to any more questions here today or get those to me otherwise.
Nick, you have a question.
Well, I have a couple. There's reference to MU and what MU is doing and what we're doing with them. But I don't know that there's much there about extending that, except that it might be a possibility. Any thoughts about how that might look in terms of our increasing our collaborative work with MU?
Yeah, so we did meet with them, and I know they have an interest in increasing service based on, you know, their changing parking policy and their the master plan process they're going through now. Now, in terms of what that looks like routing wise. You know, we've essentially throughout this process assumed that you'll still have a need for Tiger Line in some form or fashion, because, you know, essentially as parking shuttles and getting the more kind of inter-campus transportation, if you will. But you do have some opportunities here with the university partnership where you could maybe do some different things with particularly the Black Route, a new route to the southeast as well. Maybe designing those a little differently based on university input. If this could be reoriented in a way that serves their students a little bit more and you adjust those Tiger Line routes. So some discussions there, but also recognizing there's an existing Tiger Line contract. Those routes serve a very specific purpose and function, and they do that quite well. And recognizing the need to kind of continue fulfilling that contract. We're not really showing changes to those routes as part of this year.
Sure. I'm just thinking of the heat map that we saw really early on in the from 2012, I think, about where students are. But I suspect that that heat map would look different now and would be, we'd see students dispersed more broadly than they were in what was shown in that particular one. So I'm also wondering about, we have private apartment complexes that provide transit in and out of campus. Is that anything that you looked at as well about developing some sort of partnerships or working with those folks who are already expending resources to provide that service?
Yeah, we did. I mean, I think the fact is that designing a transit service that goes to the front door of the apartment complex in the way that those services do is not really achievable in a way that also serves the entire city. Mm-hmm. At least without significant cost. And can you really replicate the service for that rider that's used to that front door service direct from A to B with a public transit service? Not likely. Now, will those riders potentially be willing to walk a block to catch a city route at some point? Maybe. But by and large, those services kind of fulfill that specific need from the apartment to the university. And I think this system would come more into play with them getting to work. Them getting to Walmart, places like that. It's kind of more of the thinking with the outline of this vision.
I think building on, though, what Nick's talking about is that, you know,